Hello, everybody. Happy New Year, and welcome to our first Platinum Call of 2018. Happy to be here with you guys. And as usual, we're going to go ahead and get started with questions that were pre-submitted. We had a couple. And then we'll open it up for live Q&A. Just a couple of reminders, anything's fair game here. I'm here to support you in any way possible. If you want to talk about a specific situation you might be having with a client or want to bounce some ideas off of me, that's fine. I'm here to help you out. Or if you have a very specific question, that's fine too. Whatever you got, I'm available. And the other thing is how to ask a question. So star 2 on your telephone keypad, or if you're listening through the web conference through your computer speakers, there should be a keypad there where you can actually raise your hand by dialing star 2 manually. So star 2 will raise your hand. I will see your hand raised, and we'll unmute you, and we can have a conversation. All right, so with that, let's get to the questions. The first one came from Joy. And she said, 2017 was a good year for me, but it's also the second year in a row when I didn't meet my key business goals. I was aiming for $75,000 in income last year, yet barely broke $60,000. I also wanted to have 5 clients, but most of my income is still coming from just 2 anchor clients. Is it normal to struggle once you're in this income range? It just feels like once I broke $50,000, it's been an uphill battle to grow that number significantly. Yeah, great question, and I have a few thoughts, Joy. The first is, of course, I don't know, you know, when you broke 50,000. I don't know what the trajectory has been. It sounds like you've been growing, but you had an ambitious goal of 75, and you're just slightly over 60. The one thing I would say is, and in fact, I'm going to be releasing some material in the Academy Insider next month on goal setting. And I'm doing it in February mainly because I find that by February, a lot of people just kind of either abandon their initial set of goals or kind of looking back at what they wrote down or just realizing that, you know, they need to reset. So we're going to talk about that next month, and I'm going to share my approach, my current approach to goal setting, which is different from the standard advice that you see out there. I've spent a lot of time in many years just kind of adapting many different systems and refining them to make them work for me. And I feel like I finally have something that works. And it's constantly being refined, but I want to share with you what's been working for me. So we'll talk at a deeper level about that in a few weeks when I release that material for you guys. But income is one of those things that I think it's fine to set as what I like to call an outcome goal. So outcome goals are, hey, I want this outcome by a certain time. That's what I'm trying to achieve. That's my goal. What I've been a big proponent of is effort goals. Effort goals works better when the outcome is kind of elusive or it's hard to measure or you can't control all the variables. I'll give you an example. For instance, number of clients. It's very difficult to have both an income goal and a number of clients goal like you have here, because that kind of gets into the how. That kind of gets into how the outcome is going to happen, and let's face it, we really don't know. I think it's better to focus on one or the other. In some cases, though, if you really want to set a client goal, I wouldn't do an income goal at the same time, but instead of focusing on achieving that specific outcome by a certain date, I would instead ask myself, what do I feel I need to do to get there? Now, I understand that, you know, this is not a perfect science. It really isn't. So you don't know. But what's your best guess in terms of strategies, in terms of efforts? And instead, focus on that. And then your goals can be things such as, you know, I'm going to spend 2 hours a week sending out warm emails, for instance. And so focus on effort and focus on things you can control. The only thing you can control are things you can do, tasks you can take on and execute yourself, not specific outcomes. And, you know, just take a wild guess, well, an educated guess, on what that effort's going to be, and then start doing it. And then instead of, you know, did I achieve that outcome, is break it down even to weekly increments where you're saying, you know, this week I'm going to spend, you know, those 2 hours, and you have that as a key item for the week, and you want to check that off. And the whole idea is if you focus on the granular steps, the action items, then the outcomes materialize. They have a much higher probability of materializing, because what typically happens is we don't know, so there's so many things, right? We set an outcome goal, but we don't know exactly what needs to be done, and instead so we do nothing or very little. So I'm really big on effort goals. Now, I would set one or the other. I wouldn't worry too much about, you know, is it 5 clients, is it 6 clients, is it 3 clients. I do feel that I agree with you. I think 2 clients is not diversified enough, so I do think you need more than that. But if you focus on doing the right things, you're going to end up landing new clients. So that's just going to kind of come about as a result of this. And then to answer your direct question, which is it normal to struggle once you get to this point? I see a lot of that, and I find that 90% of it is really about switching strategies, implementing the right strategies. My advice to you would be to go back to the Get Better Clients roadmap. I would take the assessment again inside the academy, see where you are in the roadmap, and really focused on the weakest point, which is what the self-assessment points out to you. And then again, just methodically deploying what you're learning there. If you focus on your weakest point, and then you move to the next weakest area in the roadmap, then your efforts are going to be directed the right way. Try to stay focused on that, because it's very easy to get sidetracked and start trying to do way too many things. And again, when you try to do too many things, you end up doing nothing or very little. So stay focused, keep your head down, and but start with that, with the roadmap. I really feel that that's, and again, I don't know where you are there or when the last time was you took it, but if it's been more than a couple of months, go ahead and do that. Here's the good news. The good news is if you said you're just a little bit over 60, I've actually found that it's fairly easy to make significant improvements from there. Where it starts getting a little bit harder, believe it or not, is kind of at the $150,000 level. To grow that, that's where you start seeing another inflection point where it becomes significantly harder to make big improvements. So you're right now at a point where actually with the right strategy, it's going to be easier than you think. And by that, I mean it's about tweaking and changing a few different things that are going to make a huge, huge impact. All right. The next one is from Andrea, and he says, I know you don't teach freelance writers how to improve their writing skills, but I was wondering if you have any recommendations on how to write faster. I'm planning to look for higher-paying clients in 2018, but my other goal is to spend less time completing assignments to increase my internal hourly rate. Thanks, and Happy New Year to all of you from Italy. Awesome. Yeah, great question. I have a few ideas. The first one is more directly related to your specific question. How do I write faster? The best resource I've found for this, and there's a few out there, but it's from Daphne Gray Grant. And I did an interview with her. Let me see. I'll tell you what episode number it was. I think it was episode 8, or no, it's 12. So b2blauncher.com/episode12. So check out the interview with her, and she goes through this 8-step process for writing faster and writing better at the same time. It's super simple, and when you see the 8 steps, you say, well, that makes perfect sense. I love this. Gives me a structure. It gives me a framework. The problem is the discipline. Many of us just don't do it that way. So it's really a new habit you have to create. But check out her advice there. She's also got a PDF guide that's got more detail on each of those 8 steps that's very affordable. So those are immediate things. I think if you start implementing what she does, I mean, like within a day or two, you're going to see a significant difference. But once it becomes a habit and you practice it, and it becomes just the way that you approach your writing, the difference is massive. The other thing that I found really helps is to, as you grow, start standardizing in terms of the types of projects you take on, and in terms of how you approach them. By standardizing is maybe not the right word, specializing. For instance, if you start focusing more on white papers, ebooks, and reports and articles, okay, just all those kind of follow, they kind of fall into a specific type they're all thematic, right? They're all kind of the same in that the approach, the way you approach the project is very similar. When you do that, you become more efficient. But if you're doing that and then some web copy and then some direct response and or some lead generating copywriting for your B2B clients, your creative energies are kind of all over the place. So it's a lot of stop and go. So when you can kind of standardize and specialize in certain areas, doesn't have to be one type of project, but projects that kind of follow a very similar approach, then you start getting some efficiencies. That's kind of the next step. And then what might happen after that, Andrea, is over time, after a year or two of doing that, you might find, hey, like my buddy Gordon Graham does, all he does is white papers. Or like my friend Casey Hibbard does, is all she does is case studies. And then you're really so specialized that you can become ultra efficient at your work because you could do this stuff with, you know, blindfolded essentially. So that would be another. Then within those projects, the next thing I would do, no matter if you decide to specialize or to streamline, you know, kind of the projects you offer, the one thing I would absolutely do is within those projects, I would try to break down in the process you're using right now. So deconstruct the way you're approaching it. And I bet it's kind of all over the place. I know it is for most people. You know, you're just kind of doing each project on an ad hoc basis. You're approaching each one individually and just kind of, well, you know, I think I need to maybe have a kickoff call, and then after that maybe, I don't know, read through my notes and I guess do some research. No, there should be a very specific internal process that you have that you follow and continue to refine. So start by reverse engineering what you're doing now, even if it's messy. Don't worry, this is not to show anybody. This is just for your own use. And then try to look at it objectively and say, you know, how would I maybe move some of this around? How would I make this a little bit more structured, more efficient? And then move some of these pieces around, add steps, take away steps objectively, right? Now that you see it there in front of you as a list or as a list of items, do it that way. And then apply that to your next project and see and practice how that works. So the idea is to try to become more efficient by documenting your standard operating procedures, the way you approach each project, and you're going to continue to refine that. What will happen is over time, you're going to have kind of your standard questionnaire that you're going to use, and you're about to have a kickoff call with a client, and that's maybe step number two. And you know, part of that step 2A is to take the master list of questions that you would ask for that project in the kickoff call, and then customize it based on what you know about the client and the project. So you customize it and you use that as your guide, and then you have the call, and then you move on to the next step. You know exactly what you need to do, and that's a great way to cut easily 30% off the time of a project. So those are three ideas that will have a significant impact on your efficiency. All right, so star two. Those are the only questions that were pre-submitted. If you want to have a conversation, ask a question, I am here for you. See, Liz just submitted a question saying, do you have any tips? And she said, sorry if this is last minute. No, there's no last minute, Liz. No worries. That's why I'm here. So anything you got right now, I'm here at your disposal. She asked, do you have any tips for making myself cut off research for projects before I spend too much time. I know I spend too much time researching, both because I love it and it's a way to put off actually writing. Yeah, great question. I had the same problem. And I remember, actually, I mentioned Gordon Graham a minute ago. I asked him this question because back then, you know, when I started writing white papers, there was really no information out there on how to tackle these projects. And I felt like I was spending maybe a little bit too much time researching. And then I had a conversation with him about what I was doing, and he was shocked that I was not only digging in so deep, but printing out so much paper and pouring over so much research. So he made it clear to me that, you know, I was maybe doing too much. For a 7-page white paper, I was spending hours and hours and hours, and I had a stack maybe 2 inches thick of research I had printed out. So there's no formula, but here's what I typically do. I kind of I like to create some sort of really rough outline as early in the process as possible. Might be 3, 4, maybe 5 vague points that flow together logically, okay? So kind of a talk-through outline. I call it a talk-through outline because if I were to, I could talk it through to somebody, especially even a layperson. Sometimes I'll even do it to myself. I'll literally just talk it through and record myself saying it, and that ends up being my initial outline. So those are kind of my building blocks. That's kind of the foundation. And I know I'm going to refine it. I know I'm going to get more granular, but I need a starting place. So once I have that, then I know what I need to find. So let's say there's 5 points. I'm looking through the research maybe the client sent me, and I'm just figuring out, okay, where does it go in the outline? And I literally go into my Word document that contains that outline, and I'll start inserting document numbers. So I have an indexing system where, let's say the client sent me, I don't know, 10 different documents. I'll number them. Actually, I do letters for, I won't get into the details, but A, B, C, D, and so forth. And let's say that document A is more about point number 4. There's some about point number 2 there as well. Document B kind of fits into point number 1. Document C fits into all 4 of them, right? So now I'm starting to see where I have documentation, where I have some information already. And then I start, as I'm doing that, I'm also fleshing out the outline. I'm adding some detail to the outline. I'm not just putting document A. I'm going ahead and adding detail under each of those 4 or 5 key foundational items in my rough outline. And as I go through that process, I start seeing the holes. You know, I might see that I'm really heavy in points number 1 and number 2. Number 3 is way too light right now. Number 4 is okay. Number 5 is fine. So based on that, once I've exhausted what I have to start with, I'll start digging. And then it's just a matter of being objective and staying on focus and on track, Liz. You know, at that point is, all right, so my problem was point number 2 and 3 and a little bit on 4. Now that I have the stuff, how do I feel about it? Do I have enough? And you just have to be honest with yourself, you know. I will go ahead and draw the line at that point, and I'll start a rough draft. And I'll admit that once I start my draft, I'll find places where there's still a bit of a hole. So I thought I had a lot, but once I looked at it, point number 2, for instance, yeah, I had a lot into point number 2, but a lot of them were saying the same thing. I kind of need a different viewpoint there, or I need another point to kind of bolster that one. So that's fine. What I'll do is I'll put a placeholder, I'll continue to write, and then I'll go back and research those holes. So the way I look at it is I've moved on to the next step, and if I need to put some tick marks, some placeholders, then I can always go back to that, because I find that once I start my draft, if I stop and go back to research, I lose the momentum that I've gained. So that's the way I do it. I find that it's cut down my research time dramatically because, again, it gives me kind of a visual way to figure out where I might have holes, where I may be a little bit too heavy, where I'm a little bit too light, and it's easier to just, you know, cut off the research, which, yeah, I admit it. It's fun, but like you, Liz, for me, it's a source of procrastination, which is not good, and it causes me to lose momentum, and it actually starts creating anxiety for me because I know I have a deadline. Let's say my original deadline was in 3 weeks, and I've spent, you know, almost 2 weeks researching, and I still haven't started my draft. So now I'm starting to panic, and of course, that's not a good place to be. So I'll say one last thing, which actually applies to every project. I will force myself to start on that project right away. So as soon as I, you know, let's say I determine, well, I can start on a Monday because I'm wrapping up some stuff, I put it in my schedule and I start right away. Even if I have 3 weeks, even if I feel like I have plenty of time, I act as if I don't. So I've become really good at just starting sooner than later. And I thank myself later because I'm not procrastinating. I'm not doing a lot of last-minute work like I used to do. So start sooner than you think you might need to start. All right. Yeah, great questions. So, again, star two. If you have a question, or you can type it in on the call page if you're on the call page right now. All right, let's see. Liz, hey, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. How are you, Ed?
Good. Did that make sense?
Yes, it did. I wanted to thank you for that. If it's okay, I had a couple thoughts about, you know, that I would like to add to this overall discussion, which
of course
relates to both the research, and to me, the research rate relates directly to how do I write faster,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's basically how do I get this done faster. So
yeah.
I had something happen recently, and part of it is just experience in doing this. And I found that even though I've been a professional writer for decades, I haven't been freelancing that long this time around. And I'm having to learn a lot of things sort of over again, or maybe I didn't learn them before. So that's important. I just have to accept that. So anyway,
yeah.
I had a project where I learned a couple lessons. One was your thing about force getting started right away is so important because I didn't get started right away. This client is always great about giving me plenty of time, and the holidays were there, and so I, you know, let time go by. So when I was working on the outline, I thought, well, I need to do more with this. I don't want to go back and ask them questions right now because, you know, I had waited. As it turned out, I put way too much time into the outline. I almost wrote the whole thing. And so when I finally sent that to the client, even though I was really excited about where I was at, it turned out I was off base. And that was okay. I mean, the client is cool, but that was a big learning for me. So what I learned from that is no matter what, if I have questions, because I did have some questions and qualms about the direction. But instead of reaching out, I just, I'll research this, and I'll come up with a great angle, blah, 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 you know. And so I found out that was a big waste of time on my part. And fortunately, the client, you know, like I said, is cool, and she, you know, she clarified. So that was a lesson number one. And then lesson number two was once I had to do that, I was like, oh, shoot, I don't want to spend much more time on this. So I quickly, I thought, well, gee, this maybe I could apply something I wrote for this other client, totally different, industry. That was about debunking myths. And I was like, yeah, I think I could apply that to this. And so I was able to just, like, I hate to say copy and paste, but, you know, because obviously I had to, you know, rewrite and put it with that. But it enabled me to turn that around with a new outline in record time. Didn't need to go out and research more. And she loved it. She loved it. So, you know, while I think the idea of recycling ideas may, you know, sometimes I feel a little queasy about that. And maybe that's where my question is for you, Ed, is, you know, is it okay to recycle these ideas? And, you know, it certainly does help save time. So that's
So first of all, you know, my understanding about that and my philosophy about it has always been, you know, it's not so much the ideas, it is the copy, the content itself. That you don't want to reuse necessarily, especially if they're in the same industry. But if we're talking about the same idea, right, you're using different examples, a different way of explaining it, you know, different copy, then I think that's perfectly fine. In fact, you know, that's there's a great model there for you, and you don't see this very often in our world. But essentially, you're standardizing and syndicating your content, your copy, and your approach. So if you find certain, and I've done this before with white papers too, where there's I don't know, I found like a really cool theme in a business book that just came out recently. And it applies to two different white papers, not that I'm writing today, but one that I'm writing today and then a few months later that for a totally different client, that example could work really well there. So I'll use it again, you know, and I'm perfectly fine with that. You know, you're not – ideas are not, especially in this context, this is not you're not plagiarizing. You're essentially just reusing something that's not unique to the client. It's an example. It's a thought. It's a big idea. It's a hook. There's nothing that says you can't use that ever again.
Right. And the truth is, I mean, these are based on sort of basic formats that we see a lot. In other content, you know, like the whole debunking myth thing, and then, you know, five ways to do this better, and all that. I mean, sometimes it feels like, oh my God, we're just saying the same thing, you know, but yet that seems to be what works.
Yeah, and now you're talking there about, you know, kind of an architecture or, you know, approach. Yeah, I mean, that's even more applicable, I think, to different projects. I wouldn't feel weird about that. You know, obviously, if you wrote specific content, I wouldn't literally copy and paste that.
Oh no!
You know, but I think we're on the same page there. I think you're absolutely fine. And I do have a comment about something you said earlier about you know, when you turn in the outline, you were a little bit off base. One thing that I changed a few years ago. I was my approach before, and I'm oversimplifying here, but let's say a four-week time frame, I would turn in the outline really early, and it was more theoretical and based on our conversation, and then get approval on that outline and then work on my draft. The problem with that approach is if you do it too early, you haven't had enough time to research and dig into the topic to uncover new ideas and possibilities as to how you can approach the project. So what I shifted was the outline is something I submit much later in the process, let's say week three, because by then I've dug deep, I've had a chance to let all these ideas kind of marinate for a while, and I now can come up with an outline that I feel is going to be the best possible way to approach this. Right, and that way, if there are edits to the outline, I can have an intelligent conversation with the client about, all right, well, what about this other idea, right? Because I've already explored it deeply enough that I can offer some thoughts. But in the earlier example, I hadn't dug deep enough to have an intelligent conversation. Not only that, but if you do the outline a little bit later, you've dug deep, you've immersed yourself in that information. When you get the approval, the draft kind of writes itself, because
right.
you're so immersed in it, right, that you can get it done a lot quicker. So I know it might sound odd. It's like, oh, wow, that's kind of waiting a long time. No, but that's really the bulk of the work. The draft and the edits and all that, that's at that point it becomes a lot easier. So just another approach to experiment with.
Yeah, I agree. I think that really makes sense for a white paper. I was talking about a blog. So to me, the timetable for a blog should probably run a little shorter by nature.
Oh, definitely. You can use the same approach and just adapt it. So instead of
compress the timetable. I think to me, I was thinking, oh, I have to send her an outline when I really should have sent her some questions.
Ah,
yes. You know, I really wasn't sure about, and it had to do with where they were at in this particular market.
Yeah.
And I just made a decision and went on, you know, rather than reaching out. And she's very responsive, too. So, you know, I realize now it's like, why wouldn't I reach out? She's going to respond.
Yeah.
Oh. Anyway, thanks. That's very helpful.
Oh, good. Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. Great. Glad you brought that up. It's a great topic. I don't think it's one we really talked much about, but it's the, you know, kind of what I like to call the production and operational aspect of your business, more on the production end, right? We talk a lot about getting better clients, but when you look at the income equation, you get a lot of money for a project, but if your production side is not fine-tuned or relatively efficient, your internal hourly rate suffers. So that $4,000 project that you thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to be swimming in cash, was not very profitable and not very lucrative because you spent, you know, let's say 100 hours, just to kind of exaggerate, on that project. So having these systems, I'm glad this topic came up from Andrea, from Liz, because creating those standard operating procedures, those internal processes, and those systems for tackling these projects is something I would definitely invest some time in. And it takes time. You know, this is not going to happen all on its own. So, give that some thought. I think that could really help you open up more time that you could use for other clients and other projects. So it impacts your income in many different ways. All right, let's see. We got Nathan out in Colorado. Hey, Nathan, it's been a while. How are you?
Good, good. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah, good talking to you.
All right. Okay, good. I didn't know if I was still muted, so sorry.
No, you're good.
Okay. What I was calling about was in going forward with something that you had given me advice on in the past. As a freelancer, I've created this after school program that I can go in and do in several different places. And so I was using the warm email prospecting model to find contacts to get that into the school system.
Mm-hmm.
In process, what I'm running into where I think I need some help is that if I have a chance to speak with, like I've been targeting teachers and administrators, and if I have a chance to speak with one of them, I don't get too far. They come back at me and go, well, we already got too much going on here. You know, it's like they sound like they don't care. But I'll ask them this. I'll say, do you have anything going on in your school that's offering something after school for your artists, for your creative people? And they're like, no, we don't have anything like that. And then when I'm offering to bring a solution to in response to that question, I go, no, we got too much going on here. You know, we got a lot of sports. And I'm thinking, well, that doesn't make your artists happy, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so it kind of I'm still growing in my ability to, you know, handle these conversations and overcome objections, especially if I'm actually talking to somebody, if we've gone beyond email. And so when they're throwing that at me, I kind of like, I go silent, and I don't, even though I have something I could say, I kind of freeze up, you know? So I'm solving the pain of, you know, I feel like I'm solving the pain for the students and the parents, but when I'm presenting to these administrators and teachers, that those teachers are not feeling the pain, that they're more concerned about, you know, not having too much to do. They're concerned about meeting academic standards, that kind of thing. How do I hook their interest with what I'm doing? How do I have a better case? I'll stop right there.
Well, so quick question there is, sounds like you're contacting both administrators and teachers. Is the objection coming from both or mainly from administrators?
Well, from teachers, I'm not getting, with what I've done so far, I know I have not exhausted, you know, my contact options, but with the ones I've done, I've gotten little to no response. With the administrators, then it's automatically, we've got way too many clubs going on in our school right now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe talk to me next year, you know, is what I've been running into. Pretty consistent answer across the board.
Okay.
And, so I feel like what I am presenting to them, it just doesn't feel like it's enough. And so I want to get smarter and better at that, and just that's what I'm looking for help with.
Well, a couple of ideas, and I'm not sure. Let's start kind of bigger picture, right? In terms of motivations, who's going to be the most motivated to do something like this, everything else being equal? I would think it would be one of your art teachers, right, as opposed to, let's say, an assistant principal. Because the art
right.
teacher understands the importance and maybe the pain of not having something like this for his or her students after school.
Right.
So you need a champion. But the best approach, the best practice is to find a champion first and then use that champion to get to, you know, the person who's going to have to make the final decision, which might be, again, the principal, assistant principal, or what have you. Because
okay.
if you go to somebody like an assistant principal or a principal, they're kind of like, you know, they're bigger picture. They're trying to oversee. That's not, you know, that's not something they're going to be directly involved with. But if you had the, you know, the buy-in from a champion like that, then the champion can help sell it. So
yeah.
that would be the one my first thought. Now, does that mean that automatically the next time you do this, you're going to get success? No. I mean, you've already told me that some of them have been art teachers, and you know, there wasn't you didn't really get too far. So that's fine. That's to be expected. I mean, this is really a numbers game. Now, if we're talking about you've talked to 50 art teachers and you've gotten nowhere, then that would give me pause. You know, those are some pretty big numbers to not get any kind of traction. But if it's been three or four, kind of going to the other side of the spectrum, then, you know, that's still not enough, you know, before I would consider revising my approach or maybe quitting, you know, the effort.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so
right.
that's another thing to keep in mind, right? The other
part
thing
part
is
– I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Are you trying to stay local, or is this something?
Yeah. That's
happen?
That's the other thing is I as I've been sending out attempts to contact people, something that just causes me to be cautious is that, well, my goal is I only need to get into four, just four.
Mm-hmm.
And
how many are you now?
I want them to be. I have from my old school, I have three groups that I'm working with, but that's not feeding me. I started them. The precedent I set was free, just so I could experiment with it. So I'm not making any money with that, So I need to fill four spots, and I want them to be local. And I'm afraid of getting on someone's radar if I do this wrong.
Here's the good thing. You have success, right? You have a proven concept. It works. You've been doing this for the schools. It's just, it's kind of a free thing. Can you leverage the school staff that's involved in those programs that you've been involved with, that you've developed a relationship with, in terms of referrals? I mean, that's a really powerful way of getting in the door somewhere else. They got to know other art teachers, other school administrators who should look at something like this. Have you gone that route?
Right. What my wife was encouraging me to do is there was an assistant principal that hired me, and he at the school we were at, he got fired. I'll just throw this out there. Don't know if it will help us or not, but that school, when I did my research, that school has fired more teachers than anyone else in the entire state of Colorado, and administrators. It just has a very toxic kind of thing there, and after that assistant principal who hired me got fired, everybody who he hired was a target, and I was one of them. So I don't have a great relationship with that particular school because of what happened after he left. But he's now in an administrative position at a nearby school in the same district, and my wife was saying you should call him up because he's got more influence than he had when he hired you. And you had a good relationship with him. So I was going to – that was the next thing I was going to do.
Absolutely. I would do that, and I wouldn't hesitate. I feel like based on what you're trying to do – and this is good stuff because, I know it's a little bit outside the realm with many people on the call are doing. But the principles are still the same, right? You're trying to get in the door to sell a creative program at these schools.
Right.
And, you've tried warm mule prospecting. That hasn't really gotten you anywhere. But for every 10 prospecting emails, one call to the right person, somebody you got a relationship with, could be even more powerful than sending 10 great warm emails. So not that I would give up on those, but I would look at your highest probability action right now in terms of impact is going to be those relationships when it comes to something like this. So I would absolutely go there. And like you said, the good thing is you only need, four of these. It maybe not just even at his school, but you might be able to get referrals to, another four or five, two of which could turn into, clients for you.
Right. Okay. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
All you need is a little bit of momentum,
Yeah, definitely. Is there any of the execution plans I should revisit just to tidy up my message? It's like I've got so many pluses for this thing. that I'm like, why are you guys not interested? I mean, it's not even going to cost you anything.
Yeah.
Because the parents want to pay for this, you know, so.
Well, you know, here's the thing, and this has been a frustration of mine for years, and the moment you just kind of accept it, then the more peace you'll have in your life is, you know, people can only – I read this – I wish I could find this study, but this is a book on sales that I read years ago, and I've seen this reference before several more times, and I still haven't found the exact source. I do believe it's true, though. People can only have about 7 at the most kind of top-of-mind items at any given time. So, for instance, let's say that, I don't know, you know, your oldest kid's got a problem at school. You know, your boss is a real pain. You know, you could stand to lose, like, 40 pounds. Like, now we're like, up to, what, 3 or 4 items there. There's enough room in your life in general, in all the roles of your life, for only 7 things. And if somebody comes to you with an idea and it's not directly or even kind of in the neighborhood of one of those 7 items, it's not going to – they're not going to jump on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So it's just human nature. Don't take it personal. It just – it happened to be one of those things that today, the teachers you talked to and the administrators you talked to, it wasn't one of those 7 items or related to one of those 7 items. That's such an important concept to remember, because what that means is, for any of us who are prospecting, is the reason it's kind of a numbers game, even though you're trying to optimize your approach and your message, is that it's all about timing. Somebody who doesn't, that's not one of the top items right now, in 3 months, it could be. So that's why you got to keep plugging along, because you just never know. And that also explains why lead nurturing your not yet ready prospects is so critical. Because again, today is a no, but 3-4 months, it could be a I need it now kind of situation.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Is there any way I could leverage the students and parents I'm still working with? I mean, in the original program I started, I had 48 kids, which was almost all of the artistic kids in the entire middle school. You know, so I almost had 100% of the creatives that were in this thing, and they were begging me to do it through the summer. You know, so I had hit a nerve with it, and some of the parents were like, "You should do this in other schools," because they were that enthusiastic because they saw how their kid loved it. Is there a way I could leverage that kind of momentum that I still have to connect me to other schools? I mean, I don't know how to make those connections work, but just thought I'd ask.
Yeah, I absolutely. So we talked about the teachers and administrators you're involved with at that school, and you already mentioned one who's moved on. But I would explore others that you were in touch with while you're, you know, doing that program, not just the one you're going to call. And then the next group would be parents. Because it sounds like it's been a couple of years, those kids are probably not in high schools, in different high schools, and they could be your entree into those schools, right? So I would reach out to each of them individually and explain just briefly, you know, I'm looking to get this kickstarted. I know you had expressed to me how, if you happen to know that, right, how valuable this program was. I'm curious if you would be willing to help me make an introduction, you know, with Johnny's teachers or administrators, something like that. So whatever you feel is appropriate, but wherever you got comments, I would absolutely go back to them. And those who you didn't hear from, you should assume that the it was a positive thing. And maybe you tone it down a little bit in those cases where you don't have information or feedback from the parent. You say, look, I'm trying to expand this into other schools. I'm curious where, you know, where Susan might be in high school. right now? Where might she be attending?
Okay. That's good. That really gives me something. I've got a group of like ninth graders that meets at my house once a month because my daughter was in this thing and they're all of her friends that were in it, and they're in like four different high schools. That could be.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, this is a very grassroots approach. You know, don't send a mass email. Just contact each parent individually, or, you know, in some cases while they're picking up their kid, it's like, hey, let me talk to you. I got to, you know, remember we did this back at that school. You know, I'm looking to get this in some of the high schools. Do you happen to know the art teacher? Would you consider making an introduction? I'm trying to start a conversation with some of these schools because I know this is badly needed.
Wow. Okay. That's great.
Don't be afraid to ask for those referrals, Nathan, because the first thing you have to do, I mean, you've already sold me. The first sale is to you. The first sale is convincing yourself that this is something that's not just worthwhile, but has huge value, huge impact, and people loved. And you have to feel 100% confident that this is something that would work really, really well and would benefit so many kids and parents. Like, you can't be shy about it. So spend some time doing some soul searching on that. And because when you go out there, you know, you're going to get some, or you're not going to be able to get a hold of some people, or some people aren't going to write you back or call you back, and that's going to be discouraging. So you got to go into this with it motivated and pumped.
That's good. Okay. All right. I don't know why I couldn't. I was just blind to some of these options, but you helped me see them in this conversation.
Great.
So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. Good luck. Hey, keep me posted. Let us know how you do.
I'll do that, definitely. All right. Well, thank you, Ed.
Oh, you're welcome, Nathan. Take care, buddy. Good luck. You know, it's to Nathan's last comment there, the reason we can't see it is not because there's anything wrong with us. It's because we're too close to our own stuff. I'm too close to my own stuff. I need somebody looking in who can, you know, maybe point some things out for me. So don't ever feel bad. Like, gosh, how come I didn't see that? We're too emotionally involved and wrapped up in our own stuff. So that makes us blind to some opportunities and possibilities, which is why it's helpful to, you know, get a different perspective. Honestly, even if it's a third party who may not really know too much about it, if you can explain it to them. In fact, I've found that sometimes just explaining it to a third party who is out of the business, which means that I would now have to kind of break it down for them and explain it at a layman's level, helps me, because as I talk it through, I start seeing some potential solutions. So that's something else to try too when you're ever facing something. Just talk to, you know, your spouse, a friend, you know, a parent, a colleague, and as you start breaking it down for them, just that process alone will help you get clarity. All right, let's see. Next we have D'Angelo. Hey, D'Angelo, how you doing, man?
Hey, Ed, what's going on? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. What's cooking?
quick question. I spoke with a prospect last week who seemed pretty excited about working together, but I did notice that she had a bit of a concern because obviously she checked my LinkedIn page, and she could see that I have a regular full-time job. So she, you know, she asked me about that. Is this something that you do on the side? And, you know, admittedly, I said yes. But it got me thinking, when I'm reaching out to prospects through email or what have you, is that something I should bring up ahead of time that, because, you know, I might write freelance and assume they'll get from that it's a, you know, it's not a, I'm not looking for any full-time gigs, and she wasn't offering me that, but is that something I should bring up ahead of time in my emails and or on my calls with prospects.
So the short answer is no. So don't bring up or mention things that may not ever come up or be an issue. If something does come up, then address it at that point. But I would not offer information ahead of time that may be irrelevant to them. They may not even care about or even notice. And I can say that because I went through the same thing, D'Angelo, right? For 3 years I was doing this on the side. That was one of my biggest fears. In fact, that fear, looking back, ended up falling into the category of things that I was really concerned about that ended up not being a big deal at all.
okay.
You just had a situation where she asked you. So, and that's okay. I mean, it sounds like you addressed it. You were honest, as you should. And, you know, it might turn out that she doesn't feel comfortable with that, and that's okay. But it doesn't mean that that's going to be the norm. What I found is most clients, most prospects don't really pay attention to that, don't care. She may have, you know, gone a little bit deeper, or maybe she just suddenly realized it. And at this point, we still don't know if that's even going to be a deal killer. But to offer something in advance that may just create confusion or might be irrelevant to them or they may have never even noticed, I think you're doing yourself a disservice.
Okay. So, and how does that translate to, say, a LinkedIn where, you know, I see all this good information about, you know, how we can, you know, prospect through LinkedIn and whatnot. And I love to do that. But right now my profile is more so about my full-time job as opposed to writing. So I don't see a way that I can tweak that and, you know, I read that it's not good to have two different profiles. Just what's your take on that in terms of, because I know LinkedIn probably wasn't around when you were getting started here.
Now, come on. I'm not that old now.
Not in that way. You know, but, you know, how would you have approached that or how would you recommend approaching that for people who have full-time jobs?
Yeah, it was, so LinkedIn was becoming, I think it started in 2002, 2003. 2003 is when I started prospecting towards the end of that. So 2004, 2005, 2006, it was definitely really big.
Yeah.
And I was already doing both pretty significantly.
Okay.
So here's the kind of the general rule. Does it matter, like if your employer found out that you're doing this on the side, is that a big deal?
No.
Okay. And are you looking to eventually go full-time freelance? Is that one of your goals?
I am, and let me backtrack. I would say it's not a big deal, but he will probably have the same concerns as the prospect I spoke to, just as far as how my time's being split up.
Okay, but would you be able to have that conversation with your boss, let's say, and, you know, answer it honestly and just, for instance, like when I prepared myself for that. It's funny, like my boss never really found out or asked me about it. I came to him once I really had momentum in my freelance business. I just took him out to lunch and I just flat out told him. But I could honestly say, listen, Gary, here's the deal. You know, my number one priority is this job. You know, you gave me quotas. I got to make quotas. You know, I work really, really hard. I do this. This is my first thing. My other thing is a side gig. And, yes, I am looking to eventually do this full time. But, you know, work evenings, work weekends, that kind of thing. So as long as you're able to explain it that way, then my suggestion would be if you're already looking to go full-time as a freelancer and your employer finding out about it is not going to be a big deal because you're going to be prepared if and when that does happen to have that conversation, then I would switch my profile so that it really highlights your freelance business, and then it kind of makes your current job not disappear, but more of a background thing. Now, in the timeline, it's going to show both things, like, you know, like your current job, it's going to show, you know, 2013 through today, and then your freelance business, you know, what, a year from a year ago through today as well. There's going to be that overlap. I see that a lot out there, by the way. And most people don't really pay attention. But what your headline, your LinkedIn headline, and your main description is going to really just focus on your freelance business. And the reason I ask you those questions is, you know, if you're looking to continue as an employee and just do this on the side, then I wouldn't do it that way, because if a great recruiter comes with a wonderful opportunity and they see that, they're going to pass you by, right? But if you don't care about that, then, you know, or if you're not worried about your employer finding out, then it's not an issue. So highlight and accentuate your freelance business on LinkedIn, and then, of course, your career leading up to this point, the background you've had.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
No, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, you know, I can see that happening too. I think the big thing is, with this being such a smaller company, you know, they want to squeeze as much, you know, as much of your time as they can, just because they're trying to grow something. You know what I'm saying? But I can see me being able to do that with my profile and it not being an issue. So that's those are some things I can think on for sure.
Okay. Yeah, and then you just got to be extra careful that, you know, nothing you do is misconstrued as being, you know, working on company time or whatever, right? I was always very cautious. I kind of had it good in that I was paid on performance. Yeah, I had a salary, but it was a relatively small software company, and we had quarterly numbers we had to make. And people who didn't make them, they were just fired. I mean, there was no, like, oh, we're going to put you on a one-year probation. No. Like, a couple of bad quarters, you would be out of there. So I couldn't afford to slack off, you know?
Yeah, same here. I hear you. Not sales, but it's more like a consulting type of gig where, you know, we got clients who need updates what feels like every 5 minutes. So, and that's one thing I told, you know, I was just reaching for – because I honestly wasn't prepared for that question, but I was reaching for, you know, things to say. But I told her that I said, no, I get up pretty early to write and keep these things separate. So, which is true, because I do get up at 4:45 every morning to start, you know, prospecting and write an email. So,
Just, and you know, what I would, you need to practice, you need to think about a response that you would give maybe the next person who asks if it were to happen, and have those talking points ready and rehearse it. And say something to the effect of, yes, it's true, you know, this is my main gig and I do this on the side. However, it's a very serious side business. I've been doing it for X number of months or number of years. And it's, you know, the way I think of it is my employer is my main client. However, I have found that the deadlines I give my clients and, you know, the, how quickly I turn things around is on par with what a full-time freelancer would do. You know, with a full-time freelancer who's good at what they do and they have several clients, they're not going to be able to turn things around overnight. You know, same with me. So there are ways to spin that in a very ethical and sincere way to maybe ease some concerns. And, you know, the good news, D'Angelo, is we've entered an age where this is becoming much more common.
Yeah.
And I will also say, if a client has a problem with it, that's okay. Try to let go of, you know, the emotion of like, oh, man, that just really sucks. And instead, just tell yourself that, you know what, if that's a problem for them, they're just not the right client for me today. They might be in a year, you know, but today they have a different need and concern that I just can't address. You know, if that's really a hang-up, there's nothing I can do, and that's okay. I'm willing to let go of that.
Okay. No, that's helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Yeah, I had had all kinds of like little scripts like that, just typed up and laminated that I would just, you know, if I were to be put on the spot, I'd be able to just kind of go into my file really quick and take it out and just have those talking points in front of me, and I would have rehearsed them a few times before so that I'd be able to, I rarely had to do that. It was the funny thing. So, but yeah, and the other thing I would say too with these situations, transitional, these are temporary problems, right? I remember back in the day, I felt like this was going to be my life forever. It felt that way, but these are temporary things. Eventually, you're not going to have to deal with this. So I wanted to, let me see if Nathan's still on. Yeah, Nathan, so Liz typed in some comments. She said, thoughts for Nathan, if you want to pass these along, why not go directly to the art teachers, which is something we talked about, talk to them, or why does it have to go through the school? Why not go directly to parents and sell it to them, maybe through PTA groups or potentially through the parents who are already customers? Ask them how much it would be worth, and if they think it's marketable, do they have suggestions for reaching parents or potential students? Yeah, great stuff. We talked about most of that in our conversation. However, you know, something that Liz added in here that that we really didn't address is the one way you can ask for referrals is to get somebody's opinion. Hey, I want to get your opinion on something. You know, here's what I, you know, remember we did this. I'm thinking about rolling this out to a series of different high schools in the area. Do you think that's something that high school students would benefit from? And of course, you kind of already know the answer, but you're kind of positioning this as an informal survey, which is a great setup for then the referral ask. So that's a very powerful technique. I know it might seem kind of gimmicky, but I mean, as long as you're honestly curious, I know I would be. It's like, hey, you know, I'm sold on it myself, but I want to know what you think. You know, do you think this has got legs? Do you think this has got potential? And what that does is it gets them excited, it gets them thinking and talking, and then that's a nice segue into then the referral ask. So yeah, thank you, Liz. This is great stuff, and I love the Liz's idea too about the PTA, PTA and PTA groups would be another opportunity for you. I hope, Nathan, you don't give up on this idea. You know, you have a proven concept here. I think if you had thought this up and you were trying to market it, but you haven't done it yet, it would be in a different place. But the fact that you have not just proven success, but some raving fans, it would be a shame not to pursue this. So I really, really do hope that you you go through with this and see what you can get out of it. All right, star two, if you have a question or want to talk through anything. I don't see any raised hands, so I'll just give you guys a few more seconds just in case. I don't want to miss anybody. Aha, all right, let's see, Liz. Hey, Liz, you're on.
I'm sorry. I'm obviously talkative today, working by myself too much.
No, it's all right. there's no limit, so you're good.
Yeah, this is just another, I just wanted to add for Angelo about the whole LinkedIn profile thing.
Yeah.
I spent a good bit of time on LinkedIn, and I've noticed that there are a lot of people with full-time jobs that also include a freelance side gig on their profile. So I just wanted to, you know, add that in, that it does seem to be totally acceptable now. So that I just, you know, plus really employers don't look much at their employees' LinkedIn profiles because they don't have time. You covered that already. You know, so.
Yeah, that's some great feedback, Liz, because I've noticed the same thing, right? But when I was starting 2003, 2004, it was more rare to see that. But these days, especially younger people, right, the millennials, they're all about kind of putting together a patchwork quilt of a career. You know, they this whole idea we grew up with, where you have like one job and that's all you do, that's very foreign to a lot of millennials. So the trend is going towards this diverse way of making a living rather than having one source of income. And I find that, like you, Liz, most people don't really pay too much attention to it or care. And if they do, they're not the right client for you today, right? So thank you for that, Liz. Great feedback. Don also typed in a comment. Nathan might consider trying the public libraries as well. So I'm assuming that means in terms of research, or in terms of offering it through the libraries themselves. Now that I read it, I think he's talking about offering these programs through the public libraries as well. So yeah, good feedback. All right, guys, I don't see any other questions. We'll go ahead and wrap up for today. Great discussion, some great questions and issues. Love to brainstorm with you guys and offer feedback and ideas. And thank you for those who also chimed in and offered feedback to your fellow Academy members. I appreciate that. We'll go ahead and post the replay tomorrow. And we'll be back next month with another one of these calls. Until then, we'll continue the conversation in the forum. You guys have a great rest of your week. Take care.